This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, Tanzania's ruling party has declared that incumbent President Samia Suluhu Hassan will be their flag bearer in elections due in October. The pundits say it's a bit early, so we're asking, why are they doing it now? And Burkina Faso's lawyers are ditching the wigs they wear in court. It's a hangover from the colonial era. And so are many laws that are still on the books in most former colonies. So why start with the wigs and not the laws?
The removal of the wigs is manifestly not the only thing to be done, but it is one of the things to be done. And so is the removal of colonial laws. So the struggle for decolonization has lagged behind. But I don't think that we should use that argument in the debate about whether the visible signs of colonialism should not be removed, including statues and wigs and gowns.
It's Tuesday, the 21st of January. First, we go to Nigeria. The multinational oil and gas company Shell has received approval from Nigeria's Ministry of Petroleum Resources to sell inshore and shallow water assets worth $2.4 billion to the Renaissance Group. Renaissance confirmed this in a statement a few weeks ago. The approval marks the end of Shell's nearly seven decades of operations in Nigerian onshore oil and gas and is part of a broader retreat by Western energy companies from Nigeria. Shell's divestment of this onshore asset is controversial, as the organization has often been accused of damaging the environment and the livelihoods in areas where it has operated in the past, something that Shell denies. So when Renaissance Group takes over, are they in a position to ensure no further damage? Community groups have been at the forefront of the accusations against Shell. One of them is Kebet Kache, Women Development Resource Center. MM Okron is the executive director.
In the first place, women do not have access to land traditionally, except now that when women have money, they can buy their own plots of land. So the first experience is that the farmlands that women use are given to them by their fathers or their husbands. And this land are taken away for oil projects without the women being consulted. So in the first place, they are displaced from traditional occupations. And the little land that is left for farming is also affected by oil spillage, by pipelines, by sites of gas flaring. This has also affected the productivity of women when it comes to farming. Oil is also spilled into rivers and streams and creeks, which has also affected sources of drinking water, because in the communities, there are no pipe-borne water. Even in the entire Niger Delta, we don't have pipe-borne water.
So tell me, what do you make of this announcement of Shell and the Nigerian government seeming to be ending their formal relationship?
The decision by Shell, or the action by Shell and other oil major corporations to sell off their assets offshore, is not in the interest of the community people. What this implies is that we are not going to see physically the people who have devastated our environment. We will not see somebody to hold accountable for environmental degradation, for impact on our food processes, for the pollution of water, and for the pollution of life itself. A study that we carried out in Otuabagi, the community that is host to the first oil well in Nigeria, revealed that 80 women whose blood samples were collected and analyzed have the presence of hydrocarbon in their blood system, in percentages that is beyond the permissible limit of World Health Organization.
Was that right from the start? Because oil drilling in Nigeria started nearly a century ago.
Yeah, it started in the 1950s.
Yeah, so just under a century, 75 years ago.
Yeah, so we cannot say if that was what was obtained before now, because definitely it was not. By then, the land was much more productive. We did not have the kind of pollution that we have now. Our forefathers, our great-grandmothers were drinking from the rivers and from the streams, and there were no records of the kind of strange illnesses that we have now. These days, women are having challenges conceiving. There are a lot of women pray for children. Young women below the age of 35 are experiencing menopause. This never used to be obtained those days. So definitely pollution have changed the lives of community people in the Niger Delta, particularly the lives of women.
Now, the relationship between Shell and the Nigerian government was meant to be one in which the Nigerian government is able to defend the rights and protect the health of the people of Nigeria. Are you saying that that just did not happen at all?
No, that has not happened. Rather than the federal government taking action to protect communities in the Niger Delta and holding the corporations accountable for damaging the environment, the federal government is rather allowing them to leave the damages that they have caused over the past 6 decades and moving offshore where communities will not see them to hold them accountable.
Why do you think Shell is selling to Renaissance? And perhaps you should also just tell us who and what Renaissance is.
It's actually difficult for a community person like me to explain all that, because part of what the protest is about is that community members were not consulted, because traditionally women are not included in decision-making processes. So this divestment, communities were not consulted. And the question is, Shell having sell off to Renaissance Energy, who is going to take responsibility of the liabilities that Shell is leaving behind? This is not working in the interest of the people. And also in a situation where it is said that Shell is even giving money to the buyers to buy off their assets, it's tricky. It is not in the interest of the communities, because communities will not know if Renaissance Energy has the technical and financial capacity to take care of the assets and also the responsibilities of cleaning up the communities. There is need to really find out who Renaissance is, because it is also said that parts of those in Renaissance are people who used to work in Shell. So it is important to find out who Renaissance is, the capacity that Renaissance have, and to really know whether communities are meant to hold them responsible for the damages that have been caused by Shell activities over the past 6 decades.
Shell has said in the past that they have been paying for cleaning up to happen and that the money that they've paid gets diverted into private pockets, and therefore they can't be held responsible if they have done their bit.
Shell must have contributed to the cleanup in Ogoni. So Shell has contributed to that. There was also a cleanup plan in Bodo City, which was coordinated or facilitated by the Bodo Mediation Initiative, working with Shell. Those are the two instances that I know. Meanwhile, Shell has worked in several communities in the Niger Delta. It will be important to carry out an assessment of the pollution in the Niger Delta. Ogoni is just a fraction of the Niger Delta. The Bayelsa State government set up the Bayelsa Oil and Gas Commission, and the Bayelsa Oil and Gas Commission also carried out an assessment of pollution in Bayelsa State, a report that was presented to the Bayelsa State governor about 1 month or 2 months ago. That report is titled Environmental Genocide. It is important that other states in the Niger Delta, that a similar assessment is also conducted to really establish the extent of the pollution in the Niger Delta. That way we will know where Shell has attempted to clean up and where they fell. But there are several other communities that have been polluted that nothing has been done to remediate the environment.
What would you like to see happen in the Niger Delta? What would you like?
I would like to see oil production stopping and the devastation and the damages caused, the ecosystem restored, and the women that have been directly impacted paid compensation. I would like to see that. And it is important for those who have caused this damage to take up the responsibility and remediate the environment and pay those that have been directly impacted over the years before they leave the Niger Delta.
Do you blame only Shell or also successive Nigerian governments? Because they have the power to force companies and international organizations to comply.
Do you think that the oil company even seem to be more powerful than the Nigerian government?
You tell me. Are the multinationals more powerful than the Nigerian government?
That is the question. Because the government, even government officials that are from the communities, are being compromised. Nobody is taking action in the interest of the communities. Everybody is interested in the profit. How come the government and the corporations are placing profits above the interests of the people and the environment?
When you make your case to government, when you make your case to Shell, what do they say in response?
It is actually challenging to reach out to Shell. Shell is huge. And when we talk about Shell, you cannot even assess the people that are the key decision makers in Shell. So we depend on media channels like the BBC to get the information out there and communicate the experiences of community members and their aspirations and demands to those key strategic individuals and bodies that should take decision in the interest of the communities.
MM Okung, Executive Director of Kebet Kache Women Development Resource Center in Nigeria. We have contacted the Ministry of Petroleum Resources and Renaissance to ask for their comments on the claims in this program. The ministry has not responded, and Renaissance said they did not wish to comment while they were finalizing the deal. Shell responded in a statement.
Shell has a continuing commitment to Nigeria, its people and the economy. Where we operate, we bring jobs, support local supply chains, and invest in the education and health care people rely on, as well as providing billions of dollars in income to the Nigerian government. Oil is being stolen on an industrial scale in the Niger Delta. This criminality is a major source of pollution. Regardless of the cause, Shell in Nigeria cleans up the areas affected by spills originating from its facilities. In the event of an operational spill, Shell compensates any affected people and communities.
And that's a statement from Shell. Tanzanians will be going to the polls in October this year. They'll be choosing a new president. And the one they have now, Samia Suluhu Hassan, has been endorsed as a candidate for the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, a party that has been in power since 1977. But it's only January. It's a bit early to discuss events expected to happen at the tail end of the year, or so we thought, because this kind of endorsement would normally only happen around June or July. But we must bear in mind that this will be the first test at the polls for President Hassan, who came to power in 2021, when her predecessor, John Magufuli, died at the age of 61. She was widely seen as a breath of fresh air at the time. Tanzania's first woman president and a young woman at that, in relative terms. She had lots of mountains to climb, though, including winning over the party that endorsed her at a congress just this last weekend. Songs were sung in her praise before leaders took to the podium to endorse her candidature in an auditorium full of supporters. We thought we'd take this moment to take a look at how President Hassan has been faring, especially since there were such high hopes that she'd abandoned the strong-arm tactics of her predecessor, who was known as the bulldozer. She seemed to live up to the promise at the beginning. But in recent months, there has been an uptick in abductions and disappearances of dissidents, arrests of opposition figures, and increased police brutality. People have been questioning President Samia's commitment to reform Tanzanian politics. We'll look at that in more detail, but let's start with the early endorsement. Dr. Nicodemus Minde is a researcher for the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi.
The CCM party, the ruling party, has been holding special convening to select a vice chairperson for the party. But again, the party moved towards endorsing the president to run for the elections come 2025 in a rather surprising move, which we think is either calculated towards consolidating her position within the party or two for party unity because of supposed party factions within the party.
So this is a way of heading that off, factional fights which could be damaging, or is it an assertion of power within the party? In other words, is it a sign of strength or is it a sign of weakness?
I think it's two ways. I think first, the president is trying to consolidate her power. And of course, she has been doing this for the longest time now, since she assumed office in 2021 following the death of Magufuli, where she came in as a political novice and she needed a bit of efforts towards consolidating her moves. So she has been doing a lot of power plays within the party. And number two, I think she also understands the internal factions which could have otherwise undermined her presidency, and the fact that she comes in a weak position, having just inherited the seat from Magufuli, and the fact that she is a woman and she is from Zanzibar. All those things also play a role in that decision for her to really do it this as fast as possible.
Let's talk about the party and why Suluhu Hassan might have had difficulties in uniting the factions or in getting ahead of the factions. Just give us an understanding of what the CCM is all about at this point in time.
A bit of context as well, of course. After the death of the president, Magufuli loyalists remained within the party, and to a great extent, those really had an upper hand in the control of this very old independence party. And to be able to navigate these factions, especially the remnants, the Magufuli remnants, or loyalists, so she had to really either through cabinet reshuffles and bringing in her own trusted lieutenants, or alternatively sacking the Magufuli loyalists so that she can be able to tame them. So she was able to do that periodically. So she had to navigate all those loyalties as well as old age factions that were really controlling the party.
She came to power promising to reform the political and democratic space, especially freedom of speech and freedom of association. Her entry into the political arena at that level was actually welcomed by many of the opposition forces because they saw her as a better option than John Magufuli was. He was famously known as the bulldozer. Has she kept her promises to Tanzanian people about reforming the political space, making it freer and more open?
Well, at first, she really tried to bring these political reforms. As you could recall, she was able to open the political space in terms of media freedoms, civil liberties as political rights, as well as unbanning political rallies that were banned during the Magufuli regime. So to a great extent, also to do away with repressive laws and legislations, which gave more room for political activity and, of course, discussions. But towards the end of last year, she has actually been going back and forfeiting most of these reforms that she has made.
So why does it seem like she's backtracking? People are complaining about, you know, abductions. People are complaining about political space closing down again. Is she trying to please her party or are these her instincts?
Not necessarily. It's not that she's trying to please the party, but I think there is also the fear that the opposition is gaining ground. There's a lot of discussion. So to a great extent, the reforms that she initiated have now come to bite her. In this form now, there's more freedom to criticize administration, to call out on where the government has been failing and demands for accountability.
What do Tanzanians make of her presidency? Did she deliver on socioeconomic promises?
We see that she inherited most of the projects that were initiated during the President Magufuli administration. For example, the standard gauge railway line that was completed and many other big infrastructural projects, including the Nyerere hydroelectric power dam and many other infrastructural projects. And the economy seems not to be doing very badly. But of course, there are those issues that the citizens still complain about, which again include, among other things, the demand for a new constitution, which remains a big ask especially for the opposition and the people who feel that having a new constitution will provide a more balanced and legal approach towards governance and administration, which so far the government has failed to deliver.
What do Tanzanians want in the next president?
Mostly, they want a president who will deliver, amongst other things, this thing I've told you, delivering a new constitution, which will provide an avenue towards more economic prosperity. And of course, the Tanzania right now is also facing a number of economic difficulties, including high taxation, as well as unemployment among the youth, as well as economic disparities between the rich and the poor, as well as to also give the country more economic impetus.
And what chance does the opposition stand? You know, are they able to make a strong case, you know, electoral meddling and suppression notwithstanding? Do they offer a convincing alternative to Tanzanians?
I think the opposition still provides an adequate alternative to the ruling party in the sense that it speaks or it still demands for the deliverance of a new constitution, among other economic demands. And of course, most of the time, it's not that the opposition has failed to compete with the ruling party. It's just that the environment in which they compete is usually unfair and unequal, especially now that I've mentioned to you that the ruling party really relies on the state operatives and especially police and other state machinery to wield power.
And who do you see as standing against with the strongest chance?
We don't know yet who is going to be given the flag bearer. But going by the last elections, we saw the main ruling party, Chadema, fronting Tundu Lissu, who is a vocal and human rights advocate and has always demanded for the rights and freedoms of Tanzanian people. So the opposition party, Chadema, also has the chairman, that is Freeman Mbowe, who is also contesting the chairmanship position together with Tundu Lissu. And I believe if at all there is not going to be any fallout after the elections that are being held today, therefore, I believe there will be some form of split in terms of division of power, where either Freeman Mbowe or Tundu Lissu would actually run, be fronted as the flag bearer for the party.
How do you think Samia Suluhu has done as president? She came from Zanzibar, which presidents in Tanzania don't ordinarily come from Zanzibar. She's a woman. She's the first woman in Zanzibar, in Tanzania, to become president. She emerged in very difficult circumstances. 2021, there was a donor backlash because of John Magufuli's policies. The political environment was very, very tight as well. How would you say she's done objectively?
Well, I think to be very fair to her, I think she has been able to really steer the country away from the very repressive 6 years under the Magufuli administration. And to a great extent, we give her the credit for bringing or initiating reforms and of course, bringing about some form of modicum in how Tanzania does its politics, which has, you know, historically the country has been known to conduct politics in a very civil and candid way. And so to a great extent, we can say she has been able to really bring about some form of conversations between herself and the opposition. But that notwithstanding, last year and the year before, she initiated some form of a rapprochement between the ruling party and the opposition in the form of reconciliatory talks, which were aimed at actually thawing these relations that actually had been very difficult between during the Magufuli regime and animosity between the opposition and the ruling party. So to a great extent, if you are to judge her on that pedestal, we could say fairly that she has been able to heal the country, bring about some form of unity that actually had really disappeared during the previous term of President Magufuli.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Nicodemus Minde, researcher for the Institute of Security Studies. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's head to Burkina Faso now, where efforts to reduce French influence in the Sahel are gaining traction.
Not only have several countries kicked French soldiers out, but Burkina Faso is banning colonial-era judicial wigs to affirm its cultural identity. These wigs became part of legal attire all over Europe in the late 17th century. It was initially popularized during King Charles II of England's reign as a high society fashion to hide baldness caused by a syphilis outbreak. By the 1840s, wigs and gowns were mandated for court appearances, cementing their place in legal tradition. Elsewhere in Africa, countries like Ghana, Malawi, Kenya, and Rwanda have reconsidered the use of courtroom wigs, citing the need to modernize their judiciary and shed colonial traditions. The debate over whether to keep or abandon colonial-era wigs has long sparked discussions online. So let's continue those discussions in a conversation with the South African lawyer and legal scholar Thembeka Nqukayitobi.
The image that we see in courtrooms on television, especially when it's featuring English-speaking countries and French countries in Africa, many of them, the lawyers are wearing wigs. What do those wigs signify?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a combination of factors. What a wig really does signify is culture. It's the culture of the external world, and it's also the culture of the internal world. When the wigs were introduced, interestingly, in England in the 1600s, they did not actually signify much. It was simply that the wigs were worn in quote-unquote civilized society. So if you were in parliament, you would wear a wig as a sign of respect. And if you were in civilized company, you would put on a wig. And the courtroom simply became an extension of British society. But they have acquired a distinctive meaning because elsewhere in parliament, within the executive, elsewhere, they have been discarded. But they have remained inside the courtroom as symbolic of a judicial and a legal culture, but a distinctly British and European one.
Why do you think it stayed on in court and not elsewhere?
Well, the legal system is an intrinsically conservative one. I'll give you an example. One of the last places to be liberated in the United States of America after the Revolution were the courts. And what do I mean by that? If you take, for instance, the concept of property and enslavement of persons, although it had been abolished in law, it still took a number of years before the judges could accept that persons or people could not be kept as property. And the fig leaf that they deployed to justify the continued possession of people was that it was not fair to let people lose property without compensation. So the legal system does tend to be sort of the last to follow change because it's an intrinsically conservative place.
We're talking about this today because Burkina Faso has banned these judicial wigs because they say they want to move closer to their cultural identity and want to decolonize the legal system. Do you think that is a significant move or is it essentially cosmetic?
No, I think it's absolutely crucial and significant. I don't regard it as cosmetic at all. And I found it fascinating that this is the country of Thomas Sankara, who is regarded as the sort of prime or premier revolutionary across Africa and is an inspiration to many revolutionary movements. And I also found it contradictory that it is only now, you know, in a country like Burkina Faso that they have discarded the wig. I mean, I would have thought they would have done it in the 80s already during the era of the influence of Sankara. It's significant because, you know, what the British did, maybe the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish, everywhere they had colonies, they did not only introduce a set of new rules, but they also introduced a normative system that is made of unwritten rules and conventions, which constitute legal culture. And in the struggle to decolonize and to ultimately undo the system of the West in Africa, it's crucial not only to focus on formal rules, but to also focus on the unspoken, on the unseen, on the experienced, on the cultural, on the aesthetics, on the appearances. And so the removal of those wigs is a significant step in removing the cultural domination of the West in African courts.
The reason why I asked it that way was because very many countries across the continent still have colonial era laws on the books. For instance, I can say with some confidence that the laws against loitering, for instance, were introduced during the colonial era, and most countries, including South Africa, still have them on their books, pretty much the way they were formed during the colonial era, when we know the reasons why they were doing that was to exclude Africans from certain spaces and to police them. So why I ask, is it cosmetic? Is because the wigs are just one visible sign, but there are so many other, many more significant ways in which this could be done that would make a difference, a huge difference to the lives of the people that have to live under those laws.
Yes, the removal of the wigs is manifestly not the only thing to be done, but it is one of the things to be done. And I agree with you, and so is the removal of colonial laws. I mean, you mentioned loitering. In this country, we are all familiar with trespassing, you know, which was not only introduced, but it was also made criminal statute, which basically meant landless people that were found in land, quote unquote, belonging to whites were liable to arrest. So that basically was a means of criminalizing landlessness. And yet the entire colonial project was about deprivation of land. And many of our criminal laws were ultimately established in order to protect white property, if we are to face it. So the struggle for decolonization has lagged behind in confronting that reality of how to actually undo the legacies of colonialism. But I don't think that we should, in making that critique that the underlying legal system is still yet to be transformed, I don't think we should use that argument in the debate about whether the visible signs of colonialism should not be removed, including statues and wigs and gowns.
Burkina Faso has banned these wigs. So do you imagine that they would go further to rework the laws as well?
Yes, they should. I think it's crucial that they have started somewhere, and we would expect that the next stage, in fact, in the same way as South Africa still has many apartheid laws. So we would expect that it's necessary to obviously change the culture and the appearance, but they need to go deeper and look at a more fundamental restructuring of the legal system, because these legal systems, I mean, are more than 300 years old. And they were legal systems imposed on existing legal systems. It is not as if prior to the arrival of the British and the French and the Dutch and all of those people, there was no legal system. What they did was to convert an existing indigenous legal system and discard it and basically treat it as pro-non-scripto, as if it didn't exist, and then superimpose, you know, a quote-unquote superior legal system. So if you are serious in anti-colonial struggle and the decolonial struggle, then you must remove the wig. But the next thing you must do, you must change the law.
Why is it so difficult to change the law? South Africa still has trespassing and loitering laws. Many other countries have colonial era laws against sodomy, which people used to justify, you know, persecution of gay people. Slews of laws still on the books. Why is it that they still persist?
Firstly, there is the cultural problem that the legal system does tend to be conservative. But I think there is also another, probably less spoken about, dimension to it, which is that when the liberators, particularly during the first stage of decolonialization in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, the newly liberated states, what they found was that the new elites, the so-called liberators, they actually found the trappings of power difficult to resist. They suddenly realized the scope of the authority that they could wield. Because if you recall, the French and the Portuguese and the Dutch and the British and the Spanish and the Italians all over, they were quite despotic in the way they ran African lives. So what you then did is, as soon as you removed that layer and you replaced them with basically natives, they began to mimic and they began to experience new forms of power that they didn't know that they could, which is why the phase that followed thereafter in the 70s and the 80s was a highly repressive one. And so part of the explanation for it is the new assumption of power and authority. And then perhaps the third explanation, quite apart from culture power, is that what underpins the law is the economy. Most laws appear neutral on the face of it. So someone will say, obviously, there shouldn't be trespassing, because if you are trespassing, you are infringing the right to property, without asking how the right to property was established in the first place. So law has got this deceptive appearance of neutrality. And so it is easy to remain with it, because on the face of it, even though it's ultimately malign, it appears to be a neutral rule. And it is only when you disentangle the relations of power, the relations of gender, the relations of politics, that you see its malign elements. So law in many respects, that is why many of us, oppressed and oppressor, still use the language of the rule of law in order to defend our positions, even though the positions are contradictory.
That's the South African lawyer and legal scholar, Temeka Nqukaitobi. Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Nahar and Bella Hassan here in London. Charles Kitonga was in Nairobi and Blessing Aderogba in Lagos. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. The latest edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily, asks, can the game of chess change lives? There's a conversation with the Ugandan chess coach, Robert Katende, on teaching chess, even in prisons. He was depicted in the 2016 Disney film, Queen of Katwe. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.